The women who came of age in the 1960s and 70s had opportunities for education and careers that their mothers and grandmothers never had. But they still had many barriers to break through. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, the sexual revolution at 50. In 1961, Phyllis Richmond was told that a Harvard graduate education would be a waste of her time because she was a married woman. In 1973, Linda Mason Hunter was laughed out of a TV newsroom because she was a woman. Today, we'll hear their stories and talk about the evolution of the workplace with sociologist Ruth Milkman. We also want to hear your stories. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The sexual revolution of the 1960s and 70s changed the world dramatically. For the women who were beginning their careers during that time, pioneers in the evolving workforce, change didn't always come easily. My first guest today was one of those pioneers. Phyllis Richmond has had an illustrious career as an author of fiction and nonfiction and as a restaurant critic for The Washington Post from 1976 to the year 2000. Back in 1961, she applied for graduate school at Harvard University, and this is the letter she received in reply.
Dear Mrs. Richmond, although we have not yet received your official transcript from Brandeis, on the basis of your letters of recommendation, there would seem to be a possibility of your admission to the Department of City and Regional Planning even at this date. However, to speak directly, our experience, even with brilliant students, has been that married women find it difficult to carry out worthwhile careers in planning and hence tend to have some feeling of waste about the time and effort spent in professional education. This is, of course, true of almost all graduate professional studies. Therefore, for your own benefit and to aid us in coming to a final decision, could you kindly write us a page or two at your earliest convenience, indicating specifically how you might plan to combine a professional life in city planning with your responsibilities to your husband and a possible future family? Sincerely yours, William A. Doberly, Jr., Assistant Professor for the Department.
She recently published a response to that letter in the Washington Post 52 years after it was written. Phyllis, when you came across that letter again so many years later, what went through your head?
I hadn't remembered specifically that there was a letter. I didn't remember that it was actually put into print. I had had a meeting with the professor who wrote the letter. And I remembered that, and on top of the thrill of being possibly accepted by Harvard was frustration and feeling misjudged, misunderstood, although I don't think that I had guts enough to confront it head on.
I can't. It's hard to imagine receiving something like this, and of course it would be grounds for a lawsuit today if you did receive something like this, but I got so angry reading this letter. Mm-hmm. Were you angry?
Yeah, it took me time to get angry. I mean, not quite 52 years, but I mean, at first, you know, I kind of took it on blaming myself or thinking, you know, that I wasn't good enough or whatever. And then when I thought it through, I was angry. And in fact, when I talked with the professor, he was telling me that one of the reasons he was wary of accepting married women was that his wife had a planning degree and she was home raising the children rather than using her degree. And I thought, first of all, they're his children too. And it didn't mean that she was not going to use her degree. I mean, life is long and I didn't start my main career until I was in my mid-30s.
How did this episode change the course of your life? You didn't go to graduate school at Harvard.
No. I did wind up at Penn. University of Pennsylvania had an excellent city planning school, but I went only part-time, and you had to go full-time in order to get a degree. And I also worked in the City Planning Commission. And then I moved to Indiana, and there switched to sociology because city planning was in the engineering school there. I took graduate courses. I wrote a thesis, which I didn't quite finish because the experiment fell apart. But in the meantime, I started freelance writing and realized that that was really what I loved to do.
In the rebuttal that you wrote that was just published in the Washington Post, you write a lot about how you did balance your career and your studies with having three kids and being a married woman and having three kids at that time. For one thing, you describe using the barter system to get childcare. Can you describe what you did?
I had extra rooms upstairs on the third floor of our house. And we had an unfinished basement. So we put some kitchen equipment in the basement and rented the upstairs rooms to college students in exchange for babysitting.
So instead of charging them rent, they were your babysitters.
Right. And in fact, when I was food editor, they also tested recipes for me and fed the children those recipes for dinner. So everything dovetailed.
Well, I think that drives home an important point about this time, because not only were you and other women at that time pioneers in the workforce, but now, because of all the work that you and other women did then, now, of course, when a woman wants to work, she has all kinds of resources available as far as daycare, childcare, and mm-hmm. reviews of those childcare and licensed childcare facilities and all of these things that we take for granted now. But you didn't have any of those things.
No, but people always need more. My daughter needs more, and she has daycare, and her husband's very involved with the kids. But you never have enough care with kids. But it was a challenge and an interesting one to make things work. And I tried to combine things as well as I could.
Give me an example of how you combined some things.
I did a story on where were the best ice cream sodas. I took my kids along with me. When I was sick and couldn't get out of bed, I compared chicken soup deliveries. I wrote a term paper on sociology breastfeeding. Everything kind of meshed together, or I meshed it together.
Now, as you were pursuing a career as a food critic, what kinds of challenges did you have in that arena because you were a woman?
First of all, there were only maybe one or two female food critics in the country. At that time, when food involved money and power and influence, it was men's work. And when food involved home and family, it was women's work. So the women wrote the how to pack your child's lunch stories. And the men wrote about, you know, grand restaurants in Paris.
Yeah, in the article you said that men wrote about chefs and women wrote about cooks.
Right. In fact, I had been writing for the Washingtonian magazine quite a bit, probably writing more than anybody else was writing in that magazine. And they had actually promised me their restaurant critic job. But when it came available, they hired a man who had never written a restaurant review. That really angered me. But a year later, I had the job at the Post. And I received a letter from that magazine editor saying that every Sunday he realized the worst decision he'd ever made was not to hire me. So
that's very satisfying,
right.
Isn't it? When you uncovered this letter again, did you share it with your daughter and your niece?
Oh, yes. It was, people were astonished, really astonished. Their cohorts could hardly imagine that such a letter could be written.
When you thought about yourself at that age, were you surprised that it didn't make you angry?
Well, that's part of being in that realm, that environment. I was not ever encouraged to be angry, to recognize anger, and I was not a confronter. So that was a valuable kind of thing that I had still to learn.
For a lot of women in the 1960s, when they went to college, they felt like they had limited career choices. They could be nurses, they could be teachers, they could be homemakers, and maybe there are others that I'm not thinking of right now. But when you went to school, why were your horizons broader? What do you think prepared you to be somebody who broke down these barricades?
I'm not sure that they were. I didn't know whether or what kind of career I was going to have. My mother had not gone to college, and she had only started a career late in life out of necessity, and she was very successful, but she still saw herself as a housewife. And I remember thinking in high school that I might like to be an engineer, and people would say, no, women aren't engineers. Or I might like to be a mathematician. No, women are not mathematicians. My father wanted me to go to University of Maryland and study home economics, which my sister did. So all this wasn't confrontational, but it was the underlying expectations. And what made me break out of it, I'm not sure. I think I always felt a little bit out of touch with my environment and expectations. And I remember I went to Brandeis University, and when I first saw the school, I thought, I knew there had to be places like this.
I'm a member of Generation X. There, you know, the millennial generation has already also pretty much gone through college, and they're joining the workforce. For women of my generation and the next generation, and I'm sure the generation that will come after that, this is just unthinkable. And a lot of us really take the access that we have to all kinds of different careers for granted. I mean, we talk about inequality in pay, but still, we know that women can be pretty much anything they want to be in this day and age. For those of us who take this kind of stuff for granted, when it really wasn't so very long ago that you got this letter, what do you want us to know? What do you want us to learn from this?
I want you to learn that your career and your expression of yourself are important, and your family are important, and that you can do both. It's not easy, and you may have to make some compromises, but if you keep at it, you get closer and closer to what you really want to do. I think it takes persistence, it takes flexibility and luck, but it's certainly easier now, and that should be recognized.
Looking at your career, you've done so many different things and explored so many different avenues over time. Do you think there's an important lesson that we need to take away from that, too? Are we all in too much of a hurry?
Yeah, patience. Patience is a very valuable commodity. So get your foot in the door any way you can. If you have a goal, stick to that and find ways to work your way into that milieu rather than just standing outside and wishing for a miracle.
Phyllis, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Phyllis Richmond is an author of fiction and nonfiction. She was the restaurant critic for The Washington Post from 1976 to 2000. And you can find a link to her article in The Washington Post on our Iowa Public Radio Facebook page. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about women in the workplace, the sexual revolution, and how things have and have not changed in the last 50 years. We want to hear your stories today as well. You can send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can post on our Facebook page, or you can call, of course, 866-780-9100. And with me now is Ruth Milkman. She is a professor of sociology at the City University of New York Graduate Center and academic director at the Murphy Labor Institute. Hello, Ruth.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
And we think about the sexual revolution as taking place in the 1960s and 70s. But of course, during World War II, a couple decades earlier, women had to go to work in large numbers. Was that the beginning of the sexual revolution?
Well, some people think so. It's a complicated story. There was a huge labor shortage during World War II, which is what ended the Great Depression of the 1930s when the economy boomed because the United States became what was then called the arsenal of democracy, that is, producing ships, airplanes, tanks, and other war material for the war, the fighters in Europe and Asia. The war, of course, was not fought on U.S. soil, but that's part of why this became the main place where all that stuff was built. So suddenly, after years of depression, there's this huge labor shortage, and employers will hire anybody. disabled people can get jobs all of a sudden. African Americans benefited from this too, could move into jobs that were previously barred to them, and the same thing was true for women. So about 6 million women entered the labor force who had not been employed before and for pay between 1940 and 1946, and they also entered jobs that had been previously barred to them in many cases, and that's the iconic example of this was called Rosie the Riveter, who your listeners have probably heard of.
Right. Now, of course, after the war, the men came back, and what happened to women in the workplace?
Okay, well, that's the sad part. Right. So women remained in the workplace, actually. So a couple years after the war ended, the labor force participation rate, that just means the percentage of the female population that was working outside the home, was about the same as it was at the peak of the war, but they were then excluded in most cases from the kinds of jobs that they had entered during the war, which returned to becoming men's jobs, and, you know, relegated to the what I like to call the pink collar ghetto of sales, service, clerical work, jobs like that, that to this day remain, you know, overwhelmingly female and low wage forms of work. So it wasn't that they left the labor force so much, contrary to some people's belief, but that they were, you know, put back into conventional female jobs.
Well, and even women who went to college in the early 1960s, I've heard from a number of women, and my mother among them, who went to college at that time, who said, well, you know, we felt like we had some choices we could make if we wanted a career. We could be a teacher. We could be a nurse. We could go to secretary school.
So that didn't change until the 1970s. Well, there were some exceptions. I mean, there were always some women in the so-called elite professions that were highly male-dominated, like medicine and law and so on. But the numbers were tiny until the 1970s.
So what made the shift?
Well, the women's movement is the short answer, in terms of the professional jobs especially. There are a bunch of different stories. You know, this is the anniversary of the passage of the Equal Pay Act, which became law in 1963.
So 50 years ago.
Exactly 50 years ago, right. It was just about a month ago, 50 years ago. There was a little bit of, attention to it on the actual date. And now that law was fought for from the end of World War II until it passed in 1963, which is kind of an interesting story. So it was proposed in Congress every single year between 1945 and 1963 when it was finally passed. And the original form, and it was the advocates for it, actually came out of the organized labor movement, the union movement, because during World War II, those jobs that women entered were often highly unionized in the industrial workforce. And even though the numbers shrank, that created a sort of presence for women's kinds of issues in the workforce. And equal pay was one of those issues because, you know, suddenly women were doing jobs that had been previously done by men. And men wanted equal pay, too, because they saw women as a threat. If employers could pay them less, then why would they hire men, right? So there was a lot of support for equal pay, for equal work. But these women figured out that that wasn't really enough, that it would be much better if you, since most women and men don't do the same jobs, we have a system that us sociologists, we call it job segregation by sex, where women are overwhelmingly concentrated in certain jobs and men in others. Think of construction on the male side or childcare on the female side. Those are overwhelmingly, you know, gender segregated jobs, right? So equal pay for equal work doesn't do much good for childcare workers or people like that, right, who are stuck in the female ghetto. And these women understood that, and they argued for what later became called equal pay for jobs of comparable value, meaning you would sort of look at a job and say how much skill is needed for this, how much education, how much physical strength, et cetera, and kind of, you know, evaluate it in that way and compare it to a job on the other side. However, they lost that battle, and what became law in 1963 was the Equal Pay Act, which just said that employers must pay men and women the same for the same job. So that was a kind of Pyrrhic victory. I mean, it was something, but anyway, I've gotten a little off your question, I think.
Well, during that time in the 60s and 70s, when women were entering different careers, the pioneers in the workforce, really, we talked about Phyllis Richmond's story. Her story was commonplace, right? This kind of gender discrimination was pervasive and really accepted.
Absolutely. And so that really didn't change until the 1970s. So the other law that came along, which is an interesting story in itself, was the following year in 1964 was when the Congress passed and President Johnson then signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which included a provision banning employment discrimination by race and sex. Now, sex was added, believe it or not, as a joke. A Southern congressman who didn't want a prohibition on employment discrimination by race, as a joke, proposed an amendment to the law that would include banning sex discrimination, which he thought was so laughable that no one would ever vote for it. And then he lost, and the thing became law. And so that's how sex discrimination became illegal.
Well, I want to pause here in our conversation because we want to hear another story of a woman who started her career in the 1960s. And Ruth, you will stay with us. We'll get back to this conversation in a moment. But Linda Mason Hunter has a story about starting her career then. She is an author and a journalist. She has published 13 books, including most recently her first work of fiction, Three Green Rats, an Eco Tale, a book for young readers. And she's from Des Moines. And Linda, you first started running into this kind of discrimination when you applied for college, right?
Yes. Well, that was the first time that I remember facing something very blatant.
And in 1964, you applied to William and Mary. What happened?
I was told that they had their quota of women, that I should reapply in January and see if they had a slot for me. But that I would have gotten in if I was a man.
How did you respond?
I wasn't angry, and that really surprises me now. I think I was hurt, but I had other schools. That was the one I really wanted to get into. But, you know, I was 17 years old. I think I had been more sheltered than 17-year-olds these days. I wasn't very worldly.
And that kind of thing happened then.
Yeah, I had not ever heard of it, though. This was the first that I had heard of it. And I guess I just thought, well, that's the way the world works.
So you went to Iowa State University, and in 1968, you were married, and you and your husband took the same business class. What was that experience like?
Well, that was the most blatant experience I had, I think. And that was the first one that really brought it home to me that how severe the discrimination was. My husband and I, we had the same last name, and we took the same business class. I got A's and a B or two, and he got B's and C's. When we got our grades back, I got a B and he got an A. And I really didn't understand it. I had never gone to a professor before to ask about my grades, but I really didn't understand this. So I made an appointment, and I went in, and I talked to him. He remembered me. He remembered that I was a good student, and he couldn't understand my grade either. So he got out his grade book, and he was going through the list of students, and he saw my husband's name, and he asked if that was my husband's, and I said, yes, it was, and he heaved a big sigh, relieved, and he said, oh, that's the problem then. I never give a wife a higher grade than her husband.
How did that make you feel?
Well, you know, and this really surprises me. I just said, oh. And I packed up my things, and I left. And I wasn't angry. I don't think I was even hurt. I was more mystified than anything. And, you know, that's when it really started to sink in, the inequality of all of this. Because, you know, I knew my grades were better. I knew I was smarter. I knew I deserved a better grade. And I thought that universities were places of equality.
You went on to work at the Des Moines Register as a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
What was that climate like for women at the time in the late 60s and early 70s?
Well, actually, I think it was better than most places. I think back then, the newsrooms at newspapers were sort of raucous, busy, loud places, and I always wanted to work in the newsroom, so I was really right where I always wanted to be. There were women on staff. There was a columnist on staff who had been a columnist since I was a little girl, and she was very well respected. Most of the women, though, worked on the women's page. We don't have women's pages anymore, but like the food section and the fashion section and all that was called the women's page. There were only about 10 of us women in the newsroom at the time, and we were encouraged to wear dresses and skirts. I don't remember ever wearing pants there, so I don't think it was a real dress code. It was just sort of the way, you know, things were done. The newsroom was on the fourth floor, and it was in the era of hot type when type was set in the composing room on the third floor, and these guys would set the hot type, and they had aprons on, and it was a very inky, messy place, and I would go down to the composing room and work with my composer on setting up the pages of the section of the newspaper that I worked on, and I really liked doing that. But there were spiral stairs, very narrow spiral stairs that went from the fourth floor newsroom to the third room composing room, and it was an open stairway, and some of the men would stand underneath the stairway and whistle and make lewd remarks as I came down the stairs. As any young woman came mm-hmm. down the stairs, they wouldn't do that to the older women.
During this time while you were working at the Des Moines Register, you also got divorced.
Yes.
And going beyond the world of work, that made it hard for you to even do household things. Tell me about trying to set up your phone.
Oh, yeah. Setting up my phone, getting the phone in my name was one of the first things that I did. I called the company to have the telephone put in my name, and the gentleman on the other end said, "Honey, do you realize if it's in your name that you'll be responsible for the bill?" And I said, "Yes, I realize that." And after some back and forth, and I convinced him that I was capable of doing that, and got the telephone in my name.
So you're a single mom now, taking care of two kids?
With no financial support from my ex or my family. I was sole support of my two kids.
And you went on to apply for a job at KRNT Radio,
yes.
News job.
KRNT TV, but
oh, okay.
it wasn't on air. It was more a writing news kind of job.
So in the newsroom there, what was the response that you got when you applied for that job?
This finally made me angry. I finally got mad at this one. I don't even know why he agreed to interview me, because he obviously had no intention of hiring me. But he actually laughed at me. He laughed in my face and asked me why I thought he should hire me when there were men out there with families to support that needed the job. And I told him that I was the sole support of two little children, and that I needed the job as badly as they did. And he looked at me and he said, "Well, why don't you get married then?"
Why don't you get married?
Yeah.
Did you respond to him? What did you do?
I don't really remember what I did, but I do remember that I was angry. I probably just packed up and my things and left in a huff. I don't think I would have talked back to him.
So when you think back about all of these experiences that you had in the early 70s, you have a daughter, right?
Yes.
And do you have granddaughters too?
Yes.
Do you tell them about these things?
I have a daughter and a stepdaughter. They aren't really interested, but then I'm mom, and, you know, they've heard my stories. But my granddaughter is 14, and she loves to hear these stories. So I think it just takes time.
Well, it honestly, in today's climate, it almost sounds incredible. It almost sounds unbelievable.
Well, there are laws now. You know, back then there weren't laws. you could ask a woman if she intended to have kids. You could, you know, you could do all kinds of things.
So what do you want your granddaughter to know about this time? What's important about these stories for her?
I think I want her to know that it wasn't easy to get the chances that she is going to have, and that she should know that she's smart and keep centered, stay centered, and go after what she wants, and don't let anybody stop her.
Linda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Linda Mason Hunter is an author and a journalist from Des Moines. Her most recent book is Three Green Rats, an Eco Tale. And with me also is Ruth Milkman. She is a professor of sociology at the City University of New York Graduate Center and academic director at the Murphy Labor Institute. We're going to continue our conversation in a moment. Talk about the sexual revolution at 50. We also want to hear your experiences from the 1960s and 70s, or more recent if you have them. Let us know about your story. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about women in the workplace, taking a look at the sexual revolution now that it's 50 or so years old. With me is Ruth Milkman. She is a professor of sociology at the City University of New York Graduate Center and academic director at the Murphy Labor Institute. And Ruth, listening to Linda's story and listening to Phyllis's story, one of the things that really strikes me is how the initial discrimination that they both faced didn't make them angry. It just made them feel discouraged. And that makes me think about the fact that the women who were really leading the sexual revolution weren't feminists, weren't people who were trying to change the world. They were women who just needed jobs.
Well, I don't agree with that, actually.
Okay.
I think that the acceptance that they expressed at the time was precisely because no one was, there was no social movement agitating to change this, and people just took it for granted that, you know, men were supposed to be dominant. And when the women's movement did emerge in the 1960s, more and more women began to question that. And so, you know, as they explained, you know, they themselves changed over time. It's true that women always needed to work in many cases and did work prior to that, but working is one thing, challenging gender inequality in the workplace is quite different, and that didn't really begin until the late 1960s. The first sort of bombshell was Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, which appeared in 1964, I believe, and became a bestseller, and that was one piece of it. And the thing I described in your earlier segment about the role of women in the organized labor movement was another piece. President Kennedy set up a commission on the status of women in the early 1960s that had some impact. So there were a number, and then this accident of sex discrimination being banned legally by the Civil Rights Act, right? So all those things sort of accumulated, and then there became a much more general questioning of the kind of events that were described by your guests.
Well, and
but that really was the impact of the women's movement, okay, not just, you know, random women noticing things. I mean, otherwise, they would have stayed just like they described.
You mentioned the labor movement, and for a lot of jobs that were considered to be women's jobs, for example, teaching, the labor movement didn't really reach those jobs until the 1970s.
That's true. Well, actually, it starts in the 1960s, public sector unionization. Teachers were organized. The AFT was in existence, actually, the American Federation of Teachers, back in the early 20th century, but it didn't do collective bargaining until states began to change their laws to permit collective bargaining. That the first state to do so was in Wisconsin in 1959, and then it continued through the 60s and 70s. And as a result, actually, women's union membership skyrocketed, even in the public sector, in jobs like teaching. Teaching is now the most unionized occupation in the country, by the way. And meanwhile, private sector unionization, which was much more male-dominated, was in trouble and is in deep crisis today. And that emerged also in the 1970s. So you saw a sort of closing of the gender gap in unionization. But that's really only a small part of it. It really was the women's liberation movement that led to the consciousness raising and the wide-scale questioning of, you know, what had been routine forms of sex discrimination like you just your guest just described.
We have a lot of people who want to share their stories at 866-780-9100. I want to go next to Linda in Waterloo. Hi, Linda.
Hello.
Hi, what's your story?
Well, I have a story, and then maybe before the end I could give a little criticism of the feminist movement in the 70s, too. My story is I was a draftsman in the early 70s. I started in about 1971 at about 19 years old, and I was a pretty young thing, and so I had chance at getting some of the jobs because of that. I was often sexually harassed in amazing ways. I worked in an all-male environment, but the two examples that strike the most to me were in, of course, the South, and two different employers said to me, I was what they called a job shopper in those days, but they said to me, we'll hire you because we have a choice between hiring you or hiring a black, and we'd rather have a woman than a black. And I was appalled at that, and of course I couldn't say anything because I needed the job. And I guess my criticism of the feminist movement at the time was that they were more concerned, or at least it seemed to me. I came up in the 70s, so all of the equal pay stuff was something that I pretty much took for granted, partly because I was way too cocky. But they were more concerned in naming, you know, it was male person. And I got in a big argument on a double date once with a woman about whether I was a draftsman or a draftsperson. And I was so frustrated, I finally replied to her, is it human or hue person? I couldn't make her understand that it was simply, you know, a generic term, which led me to believe for many, many years that I wasn't a feminist, when in fact I was. I was just a much different type, I guess. That's... So I wonder if your visitor could comment on why the verbiage seem to be all-consuming, when, in fact, you know, I'm in an engineering environment where all the men swear, but if I swear, I'm automatically considered a loose woman.
Well, Linda, thank you so much for sharing your story and for bringing that up. And I think that that's a very interesting thing to explore. I mean, were there factions within the women's movement because some women felt like the terminology was more important and others didn't? Ruth?
Do you want me to respond to that?
Yes, please.
Well, of course, you know, any social movement has internal divisions, and the women's movement is no exception. So there were feminists who became obsessed with the issues like your guest described, and others who thought that was sort of trivial and we should really focus on dealing with gender inequality on the ground as she feels. So, you know, that remains the case today, and I think there's not much you can do about it. You know, individuals are going to have different priorities and so on. But I do think it's true that the women's movement tackled both things. So, you know, some people focused on the language and other people focused on the kind of concrete reality. So, and, you know, there's still a long way to go on this, however, I must say. So just as people took for granted certain things in the 1960s and early 70s, today, job segregation itself remains unquestioned. Most people don't think about it when they see a construction worker. Why is it a man? If they see a childcare worker, they just assume it should be a female. In fact, they're kind of uncomfortable when they see a female construction worker or a male childcare worker. Many people are. So, you know, it's naturalized. It's something they just see it as the way things are, similar to what, you know, the story your guest told about, you know, the teacher who said he never gives a wife a higher grade than her husband. I mean, you know, that was taken for granted then. Well, we still have things that are taken for granted that need to change if real gender inequality is to be achieved.
Well, and I want to talk about some specific cases that are recent in just a couple of minutes, but Barb from Des Moines has been waiting very patiently to share her story. Hi, Barb. Oh, there we go. Now my problem. Hi Barb.
Hi.
What is your story?
Well, I'm at the very beginning, 1962. I had just graduated, had a nice degree, went for an interview for a job in special education, and the interview went fine, and when we were all done, the person said to me, well, we'll be interviewing next a man for the position, and we probably will be hiring him and not you. And I knew it wasn't right. I couldn't, in a sense, I couldn't believe it, but yet at that point, I didn't know what to do about it. And as the story goes along, and I am now married to the person who got the job. I also got the job. They hired both of us, and now we've been married 50 years. But it was interesting. Then when I became pregnant, 5 months, you're supposed to leave. We stretched that a bit farther, but the rule was if you were teaching and you were 5 months pregnant, there you go. And I think one of the things that most concerned me is I in school was with some very brilliant people who really, women, who it was pretty much said, you know, you're going to go into education. Out of all these women, one went on to medical school, and that was a real rarity at that time. So things have really changed. One of my daughters is a women's study graduate, and the other is heavily involved also. So in that generation, there's a real leap of change.
Barb, thank you so much for sharing your story. And on a related note, we have an email from Carol, and she says, I'm 67 years old and had very similar experiences to many who spoke on the show. It's hard to communicate how little recourse any of us had when we were told, why should I give you a job or why don't you get married? Some callers sounded almost ashamed that they did not talk to us during the job interview. In fact, there was nothing any of us could have said or done that would have changed things. For each of us in our own way, the solution was to find a door that was open, even if it was just a crack to us after finding many doors to be shut. And that does seem to be an experience that a lot of women have had, Ruth.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. You know, a social movement can begin to push back against, you know, problems with the law and problems with social policy. But in the end, individuals have to step up and, you know, fight for what they deserve. And so they're both essential. And, you know, again, we still have a long way to go on all this.
Well, and let's talk about a couple of things that have happened recently that have gotten a lot of press. One is a couple of years ago in Texas, a woman was fired for wanting to pump breast milk at work. And when that was appealed to a court, the Texas court ruled that that was not gender discrimination because apparently breastfeeding a child doesn't have anything to do with a person's gender. But, you know, when something like that can happen in 2012, what does that say about women in the workplace?
Well, it does say that we have a long way to go. I'm pleased to report that under the Affordable Care Act, it is now the federal law, unlike, you know, state laws vary, but in the federal law now requires employers to provide reasonable break time and a private space for nursing mothers for up to a year after the child's birth. So that would no longer, that case, I believe, dates from before this took place, which was in 2010.
Right.
So that problem has sort of been solved in theory. It doesn't mean the law is going to be enforced systematically everywhere. But that case, it's still not considered sex discrimination necessarily, but that accommodation would have to be provided under federal law now. So that's the good news. I think that case dates from 2008, which is before this happened.
Okay, yeah, and the court ruling was in 2012. But
right, but it's an event that it took place
right
before that. So that's, you know, now, sex discrimination is very tricky in terms of the law because it does – well, I'll give you an example that comes from my own experience. I'm 58 years old, so I remember the era that we've been discussing on your show pretty vividly myself. And when I was a graduate student, there was a sexual harassment case involving a bunch of students in my department and a faculty member there. And I was one of them, and we consulted an attorney at the time, a feminist attorney who was very helpful to us. But she did point out that if it turned out, which was not true in this case, that the professor also hit on male students if he were bisexual or something, then it wouldn't be considered sex discrimination, even though it would be outrageous, et cetera, right? So in our case, that didn't turn out to be an issue, but it could be. So the law is sort of perverse that way. And so in this case, like, obviously only women breastfeed, at least except for Arnold Schwarzenegger in that movie where he becomes pregnant.
Right.
Whether that would be considered sex discrimination as opposed to violation of that other law that, you know, the Affordable Care Act today, I'm sure the lawyers could debate till kingdom come. So there are all kinds of wrinkles in the law that don't necessarily pass the smell test, but, you know, that's how it is.
Right. We had another recent case, and this was in Iowa, where a woman was fired from her job as a dental hygienist. The dentist that she worked for fired her because she was, quote, irresistible and a threat to his marriage. And the Iowa Supreme Court upheld that and said that it was legal, although now the court is going to revisit that decision. But again, I mean, that's something that it's kind of hard to imagine happening in this day and age.
Right? So right. I don't know. Now, this raises a different issue, which really isn't related so much to gender issues. But, you know, in the United States, unless workers are protected in certain categories, which they are in some categories, there's this thing called employment at will, which means employers can fire people with no consequences. They can't do it if it's proved to be sex discrimination, but I believe in the case you mentioned, because this guy hired another woman to replace this one, it wasn't considered sex discrimination, so that's sort of like the sexual harassment thing I described.
Right.
You know, and that would technically, again, it doesn't pass the smell test, but technically maybe it's legal. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know for sure, but I can see that you could make the case that that would not be a violation of the law. So it's tricky.
We're nearly out of time, Ruth, but I want to ask you, there are a lot of women who were involved in the women's movement in the 1960s and 70s that feel frustrated with the lack of awareness that young women today have of what they went through to fight for equality in the workplace. What do you think it's important for young women today to know about this time?
Well, I mean, feminism has become kind of a dirty word in that generation, in many, not everybody, but in large segments of the population. And it's unfortunate to me. I think that as those women finish school and enter the workforce themselves and begin to see firsthand some of the problems that remain, they may become more appreciative of what their mothers and grandmothers went through and achieved. It is better than it was then, but we got a long way to go. And I just want to say that that's particularly true for women who are not college educated. So the gains that have been made have been disproportionately benefiting managers, professional women, and in general, highly educated women, whereas the less fortunate women who, for whatever reason, aren't able to go into advanced education are still stuck in that pink-collar ghetto of very low-paid, often minimum wage or even below, sales work, clerical work, service work, waitressing, things like that. And they're the ones who really need attention in public policy circles today, in my view.
Ruth, thank you so much for being on the show today.
It's my pleasure.
Ruth Milkman is a professor of sociology at the City University of New York Graduate Center and academic director at the Murphy Labor Institute. And thank you to everybody who shared their stories today. We had stories we didn't have time to get to on the air. I apologize for that, but so many people have fascinating experiences to share, and we do appreciate your participation as well. Talk of Iowa is produced by Sarah Bowden, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We got a little special production assistance today from Elizabeth Terry. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. And by the way, if you'd like to read Phyllis Richmond's article that was sparked this conversation and was published in the Washington Post, you can find it on our Facebook page. And Ben Kiefer is here now, host of River to River at noon. What's coming up on the show today, Ben?
Hi, Charity. I have in my hands, right? You can't see it, right? But I'll share it with you if you're nice afterwards.
Right.
You know those national maps that show the red states, the blue states, and sometimes also purple states. Well, I have a map of Iowa that has red states, blue states, and, well, actually not states, counties. I misspoke. Counties, blue, red, and purple. Chris Larimer, the University of Northern Iowa, has crunched some numbers to find out what your county is. We'll be posting that on our Facebook page, I'm sure, too, and talk about what it says about our political landscape. Some new numbers here.
Lot of people probably have guesses about the bluest county and the reddest county.
Yeah.
Are we going to have some surprises there?
Right. I'm not going to give them away right now, though, Charity. You have to wait till noon. River to River. Thanks.
All right. Ben Kiefer, host of River to River, coming up at noon today. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, the Lincoln Highway at 100. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.